Last night, in her talk, Marie wove together some lovely images and stories of the way that the practice and these teachings and the natural world weave together, the way that these can be seen as reflecting one another in a certain way, this relationship that's totally interwoven. And in a very real sense, that's all we're doing when we spend time in meditation, is studying or exploring, observing nature. We observe it in our own mind and body and heart and in the world around us. And places like this, I think, can incline us to open in that way, to undertake that exploration, because the surroundings are so beautiful and the nature here is so close and apparent, and the rhythms of the days, of the sun rising and setting, and that pace of things. A lot of people that I meet in my role as a teacher and in the places I visit these days, a lot of people at times express a sense of feeling kind of disconnected from their own mind and heart and from others and from the world around them. Cut off or shut down, or in some way, some sense of alienation. And it's a lot of the time, it's something in this that would bring them to want to undertake a meditation practice, to enter into something we might call a spiritual life or a spiritual search, or the different ways we might speak about that. And there's this tendency, I think, in modern life, maybe much more so, to sort of separate ourselves. As Marie was saying, we tend to pull ourselves out of nature, to speak about going out into it, and it's out there somewhere. But as she was saying and pointing to in her talk, we are an aspect of the landscape, of the environment. It doesn't belong to us, we belong to it. And I think some part of us not only longs for this connection, but actually really knows the truth of it in some essential and deep way. I have this quotation that comes from the writer D.H. Lawrence, that I find quite beautiful. The imagery in there reminds me of what we see around here when we gaze out at the lake and look at the beautiful surroundings here. "I am part of the sun as my eye is part of me. That I am part of the earth my feet know perfectly, and my blood is part of the sea. There is not any part of me that is alone and absolute, except perhaps my mind, and we shall find that the mind has no existence by itself. It is only the glitter of the sun on the surfaces of the water." In the sense of these words, that we, nature flowing through us, we're part of it there. And someone once, I don't know where I heard this, maybe in some talk or something I read or somewhere, someone said that what we're doing in our practice is we're giving back to nature what we mistakenly appropriated as our own, what we by mistake decided and held on to and are clinging to as being ours. We're giving it back to nature. And I love this image, that our practice is this offering back to nature what we took as our own by mistake, appropriated it that way. So often, more and more, I feel that's what we're doing here. We just give it back. In one place, in some text in this ancient tradition, it's said that there are four ways that our meditation practice unfolds. It's said that it's either slow and difficult, fast and difficult, slow and easy, or fast and easy. And I know which category I would put myself in. Probably a lot of us would say, well, okay, I'm the slow and difficult. Probably a lot of us would sort of place ourselves there. But no matter how we might tend to think in this way, I think we can all feel, hopefully in some way, and those of us who've been at this for a while, definitely have this sense or this feeling that we're headed in the direction of greater ease, of freedom, peace. Something like that. We wouldn't still be here if we didn't feel this movement in that direction, you could say. There's a monk who's a great scholar and a yogi, practitioner, meditator, teacher, and a translator. He's done lots of translations, the most famous ones of the early texts. And he said this once: liberation is the inevitable fruit of the path and is bound to blossom forth when there is steady and persistent practice. The only requisites for reaching the goal are two: to start and to continue. If these requirements are met, there is no doubt the goal will be attained. So we've all started, and so far we're continuing. And the cool thing is we can always start again. So we're in pretty good shape here. We just have to start and keep going. We might have to be quite patient, of course. But it's just good to remember, because what do we do all day long? Or, I don't know what you do. When I'm meditating, I start and I continue, and then I have to start again and I continue. And it's a constant beginning again, isn't it? And through that there's this steady momentum towards in the direction of greater ease, freedom. So that sounds good, but you know, he says liberation. What's he talking about? What would we think of? Maybe we don't even relate to that idea, or we hear words like enlightenment, or in these old texts, over and over, there's references to Nibbana or Nirvana in Sanskrit. And you know, that might, or we might not have any relationship to that. It might never even be something we relate to at all. What's this? What's someone talking to when they speak in that way? And we see this, if we have any relationship to it, it's some high remote sort of goal that no one seems to be able to tell us what it is, and somehow we're supposed to be able to get there if we work hard enough or come to enough of these retreats or, you know, something like that, spend enough time meditating. And then, you know, it's so hard to talk about certain things. You know, when we talk about what we talk about in terms of things like this idea of liberation of mind, or so much, there's such a limitation in language. And so we're doing the best we can, but it's so hard to speak about things. Something that's impossible to define through the use of words and the intellect. That doesn't get anywhere very close to it. And we can get a sense of this when we think about how hard it is to describe the subtlety of your internal experience in meditation to someone. You can't get anywhere close to the subtlety. All you can do is kind of talk around it. But our inner experience is so much richer than anything that the words can really even begin to touch. And think about, you know, you can do it a little bit with other meditators, right? Because they've got some shared, there's some commonality, and we can. But if you try to talk to somebody who's never meditated about what it's like trying to describe some kind of food or some special, like a piece of, like a mango to someone who's never seen a mango. And you can talk about how, you know, they're so, the color is beautiful, and then when you peel it and cut it, and it's so juicy, and the smell is incredible. And you could talk about that all day, but until somebody gets a hold of one and tastes it, they have no idea. It's like reading a menu. You read a menu and you think you know what pad thai tastes like. But until you actually get some, you don't know. You can read all the ingredients. It's like that. In various places there are these kind of poetic descriptions of what this sort of goal or possibility in the ultimate sense of what the Buddha was pointing to. It's spoken about in various ways, and they're very poetic, and sometimes they can seem beautiful and have some of these images from nature that maybe touch the heart. This is a quotation from a book called, or a text, it's called The Questions of King Milinda, and he was apparently a king who was a real seeker, a yogi, a meditator, you could say, spiritual seeker. And he was talking to a monk named Nagasena. This is some time way back in the days, maybe shortly after the time of the Buddha. And he asked some question about on this subject, and this monk said this: "Just as space is not produced, does not age, does not suffer death, does not pass out of existence, does not come into existence, cannot be forcibly handled, cannot be carried away by thieves, rests on nothing, and is the pathway of birds, presenting no obstacles, and is endless. So also Nibbana is not produced, does not age, does not suffer death, does not pass out of or come into existence. It cannot be forcibly handled, cannot be carried away by thieves, rests on nothing, is the pathway of the noble, presents no obstacles, is endless." And there's another place in one of the time when it said that the Buddha was speaking to a Brahmin seeker named Kappa, and he said, "There is an island, Kappa, an island which you cannot go beyond. It is a place of no thingness, a place of non-possession and of non-attachment. It is the total end of death and decay, and this is why I call it Nibbana." And there's a certain beauty in my, when I hear this island you cannot go beyond, a place of non-attachment, non-possession, that doesn't age, that doesn't even come into existence nor pass out of existence. And then we get this kind of beautiful image of some special sort of place. But it adds to this confusion in the mind or heart, or this questioning, I think, you know, there's some vague idea about something, and maybe it sounds beautiful to us if these words touch us in some way. But it's way out there somewhere, this island we can't get beyond, and I'm not sure what it is, but we're supposed to someday maybe get it, or get to it. And these things may bring some inspiration, but sometimes they can lead us to looking in the wrong way. Just to looking in the wrong direction, you could say. And if we're looking in the wrong place, the wrong direction, we're not going to very likely find what we're looking for. And so we see this, what these fingers are pointing to, as some far-off possibility. And maybe it's only available to certain special kinds of beings, or maybe back when the Buddha was around. maybe not for us. Certainly, it's beyond our present moment experience. We feel like it can't possibly be here now. Someone recently gave me a book. It's a biography of a monk. He was born in England, his name, and ordained in Thailand. He ordained the year I was born, 1955. That's a long time ago. And he died recently, but I met him in Thailand once when I was staying at a monastery there for a few months. And he was a student of a very famous Thai teacher named Ajahn Mahabua, and lived there at his monastery for a long time. And when he came to where I was living and stayed for a week or 10 days, and we got to meet with him and talk with him quite a lot. It's quite a wonderful time. And in the book, he's quoted as saying, "I'd say that Nibbana is already there in everybody, and everybody knows it in some way, but they just don't recognize it. Intuitively, we know there's something beyond this world, but we don't know what it is. And so we search for it, and because we have this array of senses to work with, we tend to focus out in the direction of the senses, looking there for some kind of true lasting happiness, but of course that's looking in the wrong direction." He's saying this is something that's already there, but we don't know how to recognize it, and we look out through the senses, through the sense doors, rather than looking inward. There's a way that if we take this practice to any real depth, that it eventually really has a radical transformation on the way we look at things. And we have to let go of our attachments to our ideas about ourselves, about the nature of reality, all that we think we know about the world and who and what we believe ourselves to be. And so if we approach it in a skillful way, we could say that this meditation practice is a training. We train and encourage this quality of mindfulness, of mindful awareness. We train so that more and more the conditions are there for this to arise more and more, that it becomes more the default place that we live from, this place of simple awareness, that's something that we all right now can ask the question, is there awareness? Yes. We all can say yes to that in this moment. Ask it again, it's there again. This simple capacity, it's not beyond any of us. We train that. And through this, we start to trust this ability, trust this awareness, trust mindfulness more than the passing show of changing experience, of changing conditions. And we start to just learn to recognize and meet things just as they are without having to judge them or judge ourselves. And through this, we start to see how different habits of mind function and have been running our lives, and they start to unbind by themselves, not through some act of will, but just through actually seeing what's going on and seeing how we get caught, where we suffer, and we learn, despite ourselves in some ways, the nature of things, and this letting go happens. We release the need to take it personally, to claim it as I, as me, as mine, as who I am. This is from a teacher in England named Ajahn Sumedho. He was a American-born monk who ordained in Thailand, and he was the former abbot of some monasteries in England. He's kind of retired. I don't think of monks retiring, but he's retired from he's retired from being the abbot there. The metaphor of the island that you cannot go beyond is so very powerful because it points to the principle of an awareness that you can't get beyond. It's very simple, very direct, and you can't conceive it. You just have to trust it. You have to trust this simple ability that we all have to be fully present and fully awake. The way of mindfulness is the way of recognizing conditions just as they are. We simply recognize and acknowledge their presence without blaming them or judging them or criticizing them or praising them. We allow them to be, the positive and the negative both. And as we trust in this way of mindfulness more and more, we begin to realize the reality of the island which you cannot go beyond. So that's what we're doing over and over as we go through the day, is training ourselves to meet the moment and then trusting this awareness, that awareness can hold things. We let things arise and we don't have to judge them or judge ourselves. And through this, we start to also drop below the surface of things to what we've been talking about this week in different ways, what Marie spoke about last night, the more universal aspects of all things, the way that which they all have in common, that they share, the nature to be impermanent, and so forth. We see that what is of the nature to arise is also of the nature to pass away. Everything that is of the nature to arise also passes away. Where did the last week go? It's gone. It seems so endless in certain periods. We're sitting here, ring the bell! Ring the bell! In the mind, and then it's gone. Maybe I'm the only one who's ever felt that way. Anybody else here ever hear their mind saying, ring the bell? But through seeing the impermanent nature of things, seeing that things rise and pass, that's just their nature, we see that we can't cling to any of it as being the thing that is our source of a lasting happiness. It's not reliable. Doesn't mean we don't have good times, pleasant experiences, but we can't ask them to stay because they won't stay. They can't be the source of that. And we see that it's conditioned. Things happen out of conditions, not according to our will. They're coreless or empty in that way. There was one time when someone came to, people were always coming to the Buddha and asking him questions, and someone came to him once and said, "Can you just sum up the whole thing in one phrase?" And you know, you look at, he taught for, how many years did he teach for?
40, I think.
Not for about 40 years. And there's this huge, these volumes and volumes of collected discourses. But he said, "Yeah, I can do that." 4 words. He summed it all up in 4 words. Sabbe dhamma nalam abhinivesaya. In Pali. Nothing is to be clung to, grabbed hold of, held on to. Nothing whatsoever. You could say, nothing identified with, grasped as I, as me, as mine, held on to in that way. So everything he said was in service of trying to point towards this. All the different talks. Anything any of us might ever say points back to that in a way. So there's really just one Dhamma talk. Variations on a theme, you could say. So we could say identified or held on to. Identified, don't hold on to anything. We could say rather than don't hold on, let it go, let it be. The teacher Ajahn Chah that we've mentioned, he put this very simply in this quotation you may have heard. It's quite famous. He said once, do everything with a mind that lets go. If you let go a little bit, you'll have a little bit of peace. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you'll have complete peace. The other day, I guess maybe it was in the morning instructions, Marie talked about this in this discourse of the Satipatthana Sutta, this refrain that is repeated 13 times. And she went through that in the different sort of, after each section, it's saying, we've been told what we're meditating on or contemplating, and then this is telling us kind of how we do it, looking at it in terms of its nature to arise and pass away and so forth. And she mentioned this, the way it ends is with this the very ending of it, the last thing it says, one abides independently, not clinging to anything in the world. It goes back to this simple teaching when the Buddha was asked to sum it all up. Points to that same thing. And I used to, whenever I would see this, I would think, well, he's sort of pointing to that's what it might be like for someone who's, you know, who's like him, who's reached the end of the path. They abide, this idea of abiding independently. But actually, I'm seeing it as something to actually, that we should, can practice here and now. There's ways we can touch into that sense of this independent abiding, dwelling, living. So I'll just speak a few things about how we might touch that now. So a few possible ways that we might practice that. We might actually practice abiding independently, dwelling, living. So the first of these has to do with this, the way the Buddha speaks earlier in that refrain, that ending piece where he says, contemplate the nature of things to arise, to pass away, and both arise and pass away. And if we really let our focus go more to that aspect of our experience, we'll see that's no matter what it is, whether we like it or don't like it, whether it's subtle or not subtle, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, it's of the nature, it arises and passes away. The body, the mind, everything that we know, that's what it does, just doing it. But so we get so caught in the details of it, the process, and all of our thoughts and feelings about it, the sights and sounds, and especially the world of our thoughts and emotions, and all that we think it says and means about us. And there's a kind of fascination, and we lose sight of this fundamental aspect of its essence, that it's just changing. It's just a flow of change. We get swirled up into the details of it and lose sight of that. And we then, we attribute a kind of solidity or permanence, or we turn it, this process, into a thing. I was reminded of this. In one of your, somewhere you had the image of regarding the fleeting world. Was that in your talk last night? Yeah. And there maybe was this image of like sea foam. I don't know. But I was at the beach near San Francisco. I used to live in San Francisco, and I was visiting a friend there. And it was a really windy day, and there were big waves at the ocean beach. And there were these big piles of sea foam. And big chunks of them would break loose and go blowing down the beach like little icebergs. You know, they might be, some of them were as big as, you know, big things. Like as big as me. As big as a desk or a chair or something. And they'd come zooming down the beach, and then they would just disappear. And it looked like this big solid thing. But it was just, there was nothing, there was no substance there. It was the appearance of solidity. And they'd come flying at us and then just gone. with such a beautiful image of this apparent solidity. It looks like a big thing that's going to slam into you, and there's nothing there. There's no real solidity there. But, you know, it's all this stuff is going on in the mind, and there just seem to be so many issues. There's got to be something we have to do about it all. So much we like and don't like, and judgments about it all, and feels like I gotta do something about it. But actually, we can just let it fall away because it's gonna do it anyway. This is from a teacher, a Thai woman, named Upasika Ki Nanayon, from a book called Pure and Simple. It's a great little book. If you look into the rippling current of your experience, you'll find that there's actually nothing you can latch onto, grab a hold of as having any real essence. Everything just disbands and falls away and disappears. New fabrications arise and then they pass away, arise and pass away. They just keep on flowing and they seem to involve so many issues. But actually, there aren't many issues. There's really only arising, remaining, and passing away. It's because we're so focused on not seeing this that there seem to be so many issues. But no matter how many there seem to be, there's really only just this, arising, remaining, passing away. It's like a rippling current of water where the rippling isn't a thing at all. So if we take this sort of half step back, and relax, and just, it's like, you can imagine if you sit by a stream or a river, it's flowing by. Do this sometime. Or even by the lake. But if a flowing current of water, and we can see all the stuff in it, there's bubbles and twigs and sticks, and there's little animals, and there's all these things, there's a lot of stuff floating in it and down inside, but if we soften our gaze, we'll see that it's just this flow. It's just a flow of change. So we can train ourselves to this aspect of our experience, to just tuning to its impermanent nature, you could say. And it let it just arise and pass because it's going to do it anyway. So this teacher, Upasika Ki, continues, if you learn to see skillfully in this way, you'll see that all things arise, remain a little while, and pass away. The past has passed away. The future hasn't yet come. Look simply at the present, arising and passing away right before your eyes, and don't hold on. When you see arising, remaining, and passing away, pure and simple, right in the present moment, and then let go, that's when you gain release. So this tuning to the impermanent nature of things might incline us then towards this relaxing into an independent abiding. A second way I'd like to point to that we might touch into this is, it's kind of the same thing from a different angle, but letting our attention, letting mindfulness rest more within the quality of the aware mind, the knowing mind itself. So a little less focus on the objects of awareness and more on the quality of awareness, on the feeling of it. Let mindfulness rest back into the knowing that's just happening. It's the nature of the mind to know. We don't have to make it know. It just does it. We've mentioned the teacher Sayadaw Utejaniya. Now some of you have practiced with him when he's been here in Finland twice now, is it? I think twice. And I was doing a retreat with him in the United States, and he would sit with us in the morning, and he would just kind of offer short reflections once in a while. And one morning we were sitting meditating, and he said something like this. He said, awareness is your true home. Just stay home where you belong. You should stay home where you belong. And the way in that time, at that time, I was on retreat, and the way I related to it, the way it landed in my own mind and heart was this sense of I'll just stay, I don't have to pick any of these things up. I don't have to pick them up. All the stuff that arises, all my thoughts and feelings and sensations and sounds, I don't have to latch on, you know, like Upasaka Sita. I don't have to pick them up. I'll just stay here. I don't need to go out to them and grab hold of them. Somehow that image of not picking it up, I'll just stay here. It's like, I'll stay here. So we can maybe find that there's a way that we can rest back into this trusting of the mind's capacity to know things and let it be. And maybe this can, in moments, let us touch or taste this sense of just an independent abiding. Try it right now. Ask the question, is there awareness? Yes. And then rest back into that. There's nothing you have to do about anything. You let these words arise and pass. There's nothing to hold on to. Nothing we have to pick it up. Just stay there. Stay home where you belong. We don't have to claim it as I, as me, as mine, as who I am, as pointing to something essential about me. And so over time we start to trust this awareness more and more, this simple capacity. And to me, I relate it to this idea that I spoke about one of us the first night, about finding a kind of real refuge, a place of real safety in a world that's constantly changing and unpredictable. We can rest back into awareness as a refuge. This is from another, this talk is full of quotations, I'm just noticing. This is from another Thai forest teacher named Ajahn Phuong Jotiko. It's from a book called Awareness Itself. You just have to keep being observant of the mind, awareness itself. It's not the case that the mind isn't aware, you know, its basic nature is awareness. Just look at it. It's aware of everything. Aware, but it can't yet let go of its perceptions and the conventions it holds on to and takes to be true. So you focus your investigation on in. Just keep at it. If you're persistent like this without letting up, your doubts will gradually fade away, and eventually you'll reach your true refuge within you, the basic awareness that sees clearly through everything. This is the triple gem, the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, appearing within you as your ultimate refuge. It knows clearly and truly all around. That's the real refuge within. So one more thing I'd like to mention as a possible way to touch into this sense of an independent abiding. And this is something I've mentioned here in the hall, sometimes at the beginnings and endings of these guided meditations in the afternoon, and I've assigned it to some of you in the morning in the groups. This practice of just doing nothing, of letting go of anything that feels like doing and just being. It can be one of the hardest things to do, and one of the most transformational in a way. We learn a lot from that practice, because sometimes our efforts in practice, even though they're born of really sincere intention, can often get focused on trying to make something happen, trying to get somewhere, get something. We're leaning on the moment in some way, leaning on it to try to get it to produce something, some experience, some state. Trying to get an insight to come or something like that. But if we take some time, where we let go of anything that we might call our practice, anything that feels like doing any kind of meditation, and just sit and just let it all drop our agendas. Helps us see what is wise effort. Let's just do it for a minute now. You don't have to change your position. You can do nothing with your legs sticking out. It's probably easier to do nothing without taking some meditation posture. Just don't do anything for a little bit. Just be here. Does your life stop? Do your senses quit working? Sometimes there's mindfulness and sometimes there isn't. Sometimes you like what's going on and sometimes you don't. What's the difference between that and what you call meditating? Look and see. So some of these things that I've been pointing to, this focusing or resting more in the truth of change, this more universal common quality of all that's of the nature to arise, to also pass away. Or resting back into the knowing mind, the awareness itself, or letting go of trying to do something and simply being. Just a few possibilities here. There might be others, of course. But this this ability just to rest simply in the moment, just this right now, just like it is, and then let things arise and pass away as is their nature. Might as well let them do it because they're going to do it anyway. And then we see through this process that it we find this trust in the nature of things. It's like we come into alignment with nature in a simple, direct way. We're no longer resisting the truth of things. We're flowing with it. We give it back. And it increases our trust, our confidence, our connection to the idea of, or the sense of not clinging to anything, non-attachment, non-identification, not clinging to anything whatsoever, nothing whatever to be held onto, to cling to nothing. This is again from Ajahn Sumedho. As we keep reflecting on this, the tendency towards attachment falls away and the reality of non-attachment or non-identification reveals itself. And what we can say is Nibbana. If we look at it this way, it's here and now, not some attainment in the future. The reality is here and now. It's so very simple, but beyond any description. It can't be bestowed or even really conveyed, spoken about. It can only be known by each person for themselves. So we come more into this alignment or with the truth of things, with nature. So it's this, in this way, this is how I see this idea, we give it back to nature. Because we never took it anyway, it just felt like we did. We let go of any need to claim anything as I, as me, as mine. So I want to end tonight with a short little recap of a teaching, a very famous one. This is the teaching to Bahia. It's called the Bahia Sutta. And this guy, he was called Bahia of the bark cloth, and apparently he was a guy in somewhere in India near the coast, and he get in the story, he was shipwrecked. But he winds up on the coast and he wanders in and he's lost everything. So he makes himself some clothing, some kind of robes out of bark from some tree that he could peel off and kind of weave together in some way. And he's living on the edge of a village with his bark, wearing these robes made of bark, tree bark. And, you know, kind of hanging out under the trees. And so the people in the village start making offerings and treating him like he's kind of special because he looks kind of strange and cool with his bark robes and his hanging out under the trees. And he starts to, he's kind of sincere, but maybe a little bit deluded. And he thinks, well, maybe I am enlightened. Everyone's treating me like I'm enlightened. And in the story, it said that there was a kindly spirit, these devas, came down and said, "Hey, Bahia, man, not only are you not enlightened, you're not doing anything that's going to get you enlightened. You know, the bark cloth thing isn't going to do it." I'm paraphrasing the sutta here. These are not the exact words. But, you know, Bahia, he's a sincere seeker. He wants to understand. And so he said, "Well, what do I do? Who can teach me?" And this spirit said, "There's this teacher in this other area, this Buddha. He can help you out." So Bahia makes this long journey to find the Buddha, and he shows up where the Buddha's staying there, and he's out on alms round with his bowl, the way we've described the monks going through the village collecting his food. And Bahia comes up and says, "Teach me. Give me some." And the Buddha said, "This is not the time. I'm on alms round. Chill out." And Bahia says, "Just teach me a little bit. We don't know what time we have." And the Buddha a second time says, "This is not the time." And a third time he asks him, and apparently if you ask the Buddha three times, he usually says, "Well, okay." So this is what he told this Bahia. He said, "Okay." And he gave him the short teaching there, right on the, just on the street. He said, "Okay, Bahia, you should train yourself this way. In reference to the seen, there will be only the seen. In reference to the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to that which is known, only that which is known, cognized, known in the mind. This is how you should train yourself. When for you, Bahia, there is only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized." This means things that are known in the mind. "Then, Bahia, there is no you in terms of that. When there is no you in terms of that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here, nor there, nor anywhere in between. This, just this, is the end of suffering." So this kind of poetic way of pointing to, it's just in the seeing, just the seen, in the hearing, just the heard. In what is sensed in the body, just that. In what is known in the mind, through any of the senses, it's just that. There's no you in terms of that. You don't have to lay claim to it. Releasing that is the end of suffering. So we can practice this. It's another way we might taste, touch into this sense of an independent abiding, abiding independently, not clinging to anything. In the seen, only the seen. In the heard, only the heard. And so forth. So let's just sit quietly for a few minutes. Not doing anything, not needing to change our posture. You were already sitting. Let these words drift away, along with the last week. It's drifting out the window across the lake.